Hello and welcome to Open the Podbay Doors. This is the fortnightly news special. I'm your host today, Ian Gardner, joined by a couple of fabulous younger members of the community. So Holly Cardew, LinkedIn says she's in San Francisco, but she is in Surrey Hills. She is the CEO and founder at Carted, which is a pretty awesome startup, just raised $10 million, and she's relatively well known in the ecosystem. She was behind Pixie, which came out of Muru D. I fluffed it when I'm introducing her later and said it was Startmate, but it was Muru D. And we also had Hugh Stevens. Now, Hugh is a partner and one of the founders at Galileo Ventures, along with James Alexander, wonderful newish member of the VC ecosystem, member of Aurora, which is Innovation Based Venture Group. Super smart. Hugh is well versed and knowledgeable about a great many topics. Turns out he was an aspiring medical student, which I didn't know. So he apparently did that. We cover all sorts of different topics today, which I actually really enjoyed this conversation. So let's stop hearing my waffle and get over to the panel. Here is the show. All right, welcome along to the news special. Let's do a quick time check and date check. It's Monday the 12th of July and it's noon. And I'm joined by two awesome members of the startup community. We have Holly Cardew from Carted. Welcome, Holly. First time on the show. Now, LinkedIn says you're in San Francisco, but you're apparently in Sydney, locked down like the rest of us. So we'll come back to that.
Speak for yourselves here.
Yeah, I know. The voice from Melbourne is Hugh Stevens. So Hugh's with Galileo Ventures. Well, you had 4 months of lockdown last year. So I guess you're looking on with, is it pity? Or
Look, I think it at least equalizes the conversation. I think in perhaps there were moments last year where my friends and colleagues in Sydney didn't quite understand the experience of Victorians, and now they are understanding the experience of Victorians. So definitely sympathy.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I don't know how long this thing's going to last, but it doesn't feel good, I have to say. I think the numbers this morning were 115 cases. They all seem to be out and about. Bunch of youngsters, so they spread it more and it's highly transmissible. So I reckon we're here for, I don't know, 4 weeks, 5 weeks. I turned 50.
Probably. That's optimistic.
I turned 50 on the 28th of August, so I want to make sure my party can go ahead. I haven't planned it yet, by the way, but what do you think? Do you think I'll get my party underway, Holly?
I really thought it was going to be 2 to 3 months until we're out of this. Yeah. And not even out of it. It'll be until we're mostly vaccinated. So, even if you can have your party, it'll be limited. It'll be restricted to how many people you can have at your party.
Waving each other's in a cold and wintry Sydney park. So it'll be kind of miserable. Mm. Anyway. Yeah. Holly, why didn't you tell us a little bit about what you've been up to? Because a lot of people may have heard of you. You're a little bit high profile. You came through Startmate with Pixie, is that right?
I actually came through Muru D and then went to San Francisco and did 500 startups, but I've definitely been part of the Startmate community for a while.
Yeah, apologies, that's right. It was Muru D. So yeah, tell us what you've been up to, because there was some announcements recently.
Yeah, so I do still have my company Pixie, which is bootstrapped and has a team running it, but I've actually more recently started another venture, Carted, and we're building new commerce experiences. We're basically enabling developers to build new commerce experiences on the web, and also we possibly has a consumer play as well.
Okay. And you've just raised $10 million, pretty high profile set of investors. So tell us about that and what you're going to do with the money.
Yeah, we're really fortunate. We have some awesome investors on board. Blackbird led our round. And then we also have Grok, which is Mike Cannonbrook's family office, as well as Tidal Ventures, a fund in the US, and then some awesome high net worth individuals, including Google Drive co-founder and the Honey co-founder that sold to PayPal. So we're really on a mission to change commerce and allow people to make content experiences commerce experiences. So by that, I mean whether you're in a community or whether you're on social, you should be able to shop. So for us, raising the money, we've got a lot of infrastructure to build. We're basically powering millions of stores and billions of products, and we're currently building out a team. So we're now 12 and we're scaling up.
That's great. And how's the hiring? I keep asking founders about that and always get mixed messages. Is it hard to hire?
Yeah, I think it's definitely interesting. We have six of us in Sydney and then six remote, and we have two more joining remote. I've been building remote teams since 2014, so it comes quite naturally to me. So that's not really an issue. I think for us, we're actually building a really technical product. And so for us, it's about finding people who have scaled systems, whether that's a database of that many products and taxonomy, product knowledge graph. So there's a lot of pieces, moving pieces to our product. So we've been fortunate in hiring people because we've kind of looked everywhere. I think also having, to be honest, having funds to be able to hire those, that sort of talent is also, we're in a really fortunate position.
Yeah. Thank you and welcome. Hugh, maybe tell us a little bit more about you. So Galileo Ventures, you're based in Melbourne. James Alexander is your co-conspirator. He's in Sydney. So what is Galileo? How much you got and what are you investing in?
Yeah, so Galileo is an early stage venture capital limited partnership, an official VC fund, as we like to call ourselves. We started investing in September last year. So the way that VC funds in Australia work is that you've got to raise $10 million before you can start investing. So we closed the 10 in sort of the middle of last year, started investing in September. We've done 8 investments. So 10 investments now, actually, close to before the end of financial year. And we're mostly investing into really, really early stage startups. So really, we aim to be almost the first check into most of the companies that we invest in. And for a lot of them, we have been, either by ourselves or alternatively, sometimes with various different co-investors. And we've sort of seen the first one have its first follow-on investment that's unannounced, which is exciting. And yeah, so then we've been supporting the companies, you know, since September. We sort of aim to provide, we generally write 200K to 300K checks, so they're decent sized checks, and we sort of aim to make sure that the companies have enough runway with the existing team and sort of revenue coming in and things like that to be able to get through 12 to 18 months. So we're sort of, we're not trying to be a short period kind of accelerator type model.
And have you got a thesis within the investments?
Yeah, so I guess the main thesis for us is kind of what we call the emerging founder. So it's around this concept of sort of first-time founders of their first sort of high-growth, high-scale, you know, sort of VC-style investment. We find are probably underserved by the market and certainly discounted by a lot of the market because of that lack of experience or knowledge or whatever it might be. And so as a result, you know, that's kind of where I guess a lot of our focus lies. And yeah, it's been interesting so far. I mean, you know, it's still way too early. People keep saying, oh, you know, how do you think it's doing? You sort of go, I've got no idea, you know, ask me in 10 years. But yeah, it's really interesting seeing, you know, meeting a lot of the founders that we meet, you know, and seeing a lot of the different, you know, business ideas and concepts and early stage companies, really come through.
Well, you're also, and you and James are members of Aurora, which is our, innovation based, venture capital community. There's now, I think, 60 members in there. So, you know, GPs of all the major funds, and, we just managed to do our venture down under, and you were pretty active and keen participants. So yeah, it's good that we did it in May and not now, because we'd have been pretty buggered, to be honest. But
yeah, we had a founder retreat. We took all our founders to Byron Bay, actually, and it was the week of Victoria's lockdown coming into place. And so we sort of had this week where it was like everyone was flying out on Tuesday and Wednesday, and on Monday was when it was really starting looking bad in Victoria. And I was like, oh my God, what are we going to do? And it turned out that we actually ended up getting effectively stuck there. Because if we cross back into Queensland to fly home, we'd be having to go into lockdown in Queensland. So it was one of those things where it really came down right to the wire. And if we'd flown everyone 24 hours later, none of the Victorians would be able to go.
All right. Well, let's not look back. Let's look forward, and we should probably talk about the news. Now, part of the reason I asked you on, Holly, is because, I mean, you're relatively active on Twitter. And I saw a post that you put up last week about the border closures and the fact that Aussies are unable to travel, and it's not reasonable, it's not fair, it's basically disadvantaging, if that's a word, the startup community in particular, you know, because you cannot hire overseas travelers or overseas visa holders. It's just, you know, you might be able to get a visa, but they can't get in. It's discouraging people from coming to stay. People who are already here, either on visas or whatnot, are going home. Let me throw this one to you, because there was some articles on this. There was a good one in the AFR just talking about a few of the startups that want to expand overseas, including Manuri from Health Match. You know, she's trying to expand into the US. You're living this, so give us a bit more context and why this is making your blood boil.
Yeah, I think so. I was actually in San Francisco during part of the lockdown, so I definitely sympathize with Melbourne people. I was in lockdown for a few months over there, and then I came back because it didn't look like it was going to end. But now I would say, like, America has really okay, there's definitely parts of it they're still behind, but California in particular is really ahead of the curve in terms of vaccinations. People are opening up. And I think this is actually going to be a hindrance for Australian companies because although you can, okay, we raised all of our money over Zoom, we didn't actually have any in-person meetings, things will change where people want to do business face-to-face. And if Australians are unable to leave Australia or vice versa, people are unable to come here, I think just the way we are wired, people want to do business together and face-to-face, whether that is at a conference or whether that's meet up casually. And so for me, it's quite frustrating because I would like to, I guess you've just, when you've raised money, you want to basically accelerate your progress. And so I feel a bit stuck at the moment, I guess, because there will be people in America in, you know, e-commerce is booming. We're in the e-commerce space and people will do business locally, whether that's, you know, East Coast or West Coast of America, people want to do business.
Yeah. I think that's broadly true. I mean, it looks like the US is opening and, you know, you watch scenes from Wimbledon and what's going on in the UK and, you know, people, it seems almost back to normal. Vaccination rates are crazy high. What we sometimes, or we shouldn't forget is that the cost, if there is, yeah, I mean, the cost, I'm using quote marks around that because it's not an actual cost, but there was, in the case of the US, hundreds of thousands of people died. So, I mean, US kind of has herd immunity because you've either been vaccinated, had the virus and are, you know, got the antibodies or are dead. You know, and it's a tough call because like we haven't had any of that, you know, awful death, but we are now at a spot where we're way behind. You know, the vaccination is way behind. Hugh, any observations from your side in this one? Are you trying to hire people? Are you seeing your portfolio trying to hire and experiencing this problem?
I mean, hiring's always the hardest thing in almost every company, and particularly when you're a VC-backed company and you're trying to grow headcount often, you know, 2 to 3 times year on year, hiring's always really hard. You know, and founders find that really hard. And the talent market's very, very competitive now. And I think one of the things that we've certainly seen is that remote work has probably made the talent market even harder in Australia and New Zealand. You know, and you know, I've certainly heard stories of Californian startups offering, you know, $300,000, $350,000 New Zealand dollar packages to engineers in New Zealand. And that's inevitably going to distort the market. You know, that is absolutely going to drive up the cost of talent compared to what they previously might have seen locally.
And just to be clear, that's to fly the New Zealand talent to...
No, that's for them to work remotely in New Zealand.
Okay, wow.
You know, for a Californian company. So, you know, we are definitely seeing that happen. You know, and sure, it's probably, you know, the 0.01% or whatever it is. But, you know, I think that's going to change the way that the talent markets operate. And you know, we've had this thing in remote work for a long time, and I'm sure Holly's seen it, of like, how much do you adjust salary to people's current location when you're hiring people remotely, or how much do you kind of pay a consistent salary across all different geographies and, you know, ignore that question of local cost of living. And I think that's just going to get worse and worse. So I think one part of that is to say, well, you know, look, you know, it's a very hard, you know, it's hard time to hire for everyone. But I think the second part is that, you know, I think there is a bit of a fallacy sometimes, you know, in the Australian market and, you know, with respect to Holly's experience, but there is sometimes a bit of a fallacy in the Australian market of where there is a belief that you need to be in America to sell to the US. You know, and I don't really think that's true anymore. It's like back in the day, you know, you used to have a US entity to receive investment from US VCs, and that's no longer a thing. You know, back in the day, you used to have to have a local entity to sign an enterprise contract with the US, and the US companies don't give a rat. So, you know, I think we are seeing the change in that international commerce come in over time. And I think if you know, probably the only exception is probably time zones, right? Time zones really hard, Australia, US, or same thing with Australia, Europe as well. But, you know, outside of that, I'm like, I think actually a lot of the time compared to maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, you know, that concept of international commerce and international work is now a lot easier for founders than maybe it was previously. Even just, you know, we thought it was amazing the way that we did 8 investments, and a lot of our VCs, like sort of, you know, colleagues and mentors in Australia said, oh, what, you haven't even met these founders face to face? And you're like, yeah, I've hired a ton of people remotely, like, you know, who cares? And they were like, oh, but you haven't like looked them in the eyes. And I'm like, no.
Well, let me ask this a different way. I mean, how long is it going to be? Like, because it doesn't sound to me that you're suggesting that the startup ecosystem is being too affected yet by border closures. But when do you think that's going to flip? Like, when is this going to, you know, have pretty bad impact on the startups sector? That is.
I mean, I think the startup sector is probably one of the least affected sectors in Australia of the way that we're going to kind of be stuck in this sort of weird backwards economic scenario for some period of time because of that. And I think that's because, you know, technology is easy to export. You know, it's really easy to export technology. It's much harder to export, you know, tourism, right? You know, the Australian tourism market is just absolutely cooked. You know, the events industry is just ruined. You know, like you can't bring people in, you can't bring people out. You know, like there's no touring, there's no events, there's no, you know, you can't run an event because you're worried about lockdowns rolling in. I think in many ways, the startup ecosystem is quite lucky in that we actually have the capacity to be able to do that sort of export sales in a way that other industries have struggled or certainly been more heavily affected. And yeah, there are obviously parts, you know, there's startups that obviously focus on the entertainment industry and they were, you know, they had a pretty bad time. But I think one of the things that, you know, we've seen with some of our sort of, I'll call them COVID affected portfolio companies is, you know, it's allowed them to be able to shift the focus into different geographies. And so whether that means expanding into Europe or expanding into the US earlier than perhaps previously planned to tag on to the back of, you know, changes in the entertainment sector or changes in the tourism and travel sector, you know, we do have that capacity in startups. And I think it's good in that you're able to kind of pivot the technology and pivot the focus in a way that's much harder to if you're a cafe or a bar or, a tourism brand. So I think, you know, in that sense, I think we're quite lucky. But I do think that – I do agree, though, that over the sort of like 3 to 5 year horizon, it's going to be very interesting and very challenging for Australian startups because ultimately we are going to kind of, it feels like there's a huge proportion of our population that just sort of wants to keep living like an island and just having sort of effectively nothing coming in and nothing going out. And I don't really understand why. Like, you know, I think there's, you know, yes, there's challenges around vaccine supply and, you know, how do we do that? And have we gotten the right model there? And probably the answer is probably not, but it's hard to see retrospectively. You know, we bet very heavily on the University of Queensland vaccine. That just didn't, you know, didn't deliver, and that's life, you know. Like sometimes you make high risk things and you choose the wrong choice. And you know, is it better that we've routed a lot more Pfizer vaccinations out to countries where people were dying? Yeah, probably. You know, like I think on a global basis, it's probably not a bad thing. But like, you know, we are sort of seeing that the mass shift. You know, the Sydney lockdown being a good example of that. We are seeing that mass shift, and we're seeing that scenario where you go, okay, well, you know, like yeah, there's risk with AstraZeneca, but at the same time, like now we're actually seeing infection rates go up. You know, like we're no longer just like 0, 0, 0, 0. Like now infection rates going up. And like, what do we do? Like maybe now the math there is different about the actual risk return of rolling out, you know, AstraZeneca and then having a Pfizer booster when Pfizer becomes more generally available, which seems to be a lot of the strategy.
And Holly, when do you think you're going to be back in San Francisco? What's your plan?
Well, I think it would have been this year, to be honest, because a lot happens in 6 months and a lot happens in 12 months in our space. But I think depending on what's happening with the consulate, we might not be able to get an appointment.
That's the challenge. Is that the US consulate?
Yeah, US consulate.
Right. So the challenge for you is not around getting a flight and getting the Aussie government to give you permission. It's getting your thumbs up from the US.
Yeah, but not because they don't want to. It's because their office is probably not even open and they're so behind in visa appointments. I think the thing is, it's not about Australians have to be in the US to do business, but like what used to happen is people would go over for a conference or people would go over for 2-3 months to understand their customers' needs to go meet and do deals. You don't have to do deals face to face, but it's just like nature. People who are looking to acquire companies or do business with companies, they usually want to know that they're around the corner. I cannot explain it, but it's just the way that companies work. Like having to, every time we're on the phone and having to explain, oh, we're sitting in Sydney, they can't comprehend that.
I think one of the interesting things is, I think that mid-market, that sort of what I'll call mid-market exit, you know, sort of like the, let's call it like $80 to $300-400 million exit. We don't see nearly as much of that in Australia as you do in the US. And I entirely agree. And, you know, I think that's one of the big challenges of the Australian startup ecosystem is that we don't have that same degree of, you know, our larger companies locally, many of which I guess are banks and bloody mining companies. But, you know, we don't see a lot of our larger companies buying all of these sort of startups at this late, you know, that sort of like mid-market exit stage in the way that you do in the States. And a lot of that is because of the way that the networks work and the way that things work in the sense of, you know, like it's almost like you have a major US investor and you're almost guaranteed an exit. Because, you know, even if the whole business fails, they'll sort of go, oh, well, you know, you guys, you know, you'd kind of suit over here. So like, I'll go and tell this person over here when I have coffee with them, I'll tell them to come and buy you and they'll just come and buy you. You know, and I sort of like the money just kind of washes around in a circle in a sort of very strange sense of the world. But we don't have that in Australia. And I think that's definitely something that is very much lacking. And I definitely agree, Holly, that like you do need boots on the ground to be able to build those networks and connections.
Yeah. I think I'm in a fortunate position because I've been on off in the San Francisco Bay Area. So I do have those connections, but I cannot imagine how hard it is for someone who has no connections starting to build a network remote only. Usually I would say that one of their investors has a connection to someone in the US and then does an introduction. But if you're starting out in Australia, it's really hard. Without anyone doing an introduction to the US, it's going to be really challenging.
Yeah, no, that's sage advice. All right, well, let's move on. I mean, I think the punchline from that, just by the way, is let's get more vaccinations in people's arms and get these borders open and just learn to, unfortunately, just learn to live with the virus. Because that's, once we open the borders, it's going to be out there. And if you're not vaccinated, then it's your risk, I think. Anyway, let's not get bogged down in that. So look, there was a bunch of deals that I want to talk about. You know, the common factor in all three of the first ones I want to mention is Blackbird. So Holly, I'll probably throw it to you. So there's three in there. So Gilmer Space, they were an early Blackbird investee. They've just raised another $46 million Series C. And that's going to allow them to take its small launch vehicle to orbit. You know, they're going to build a launch facility in Queensland and a different one, I think, or piggyback on someone else in South Australia for a polar orbit. There's another one, Flow, FL0, pronounced Flow, which is called, you know, Canva for engineers, a smaller deal, $5.1 million. That was Blackbird led that. And, you know, I have a slight bias here because Gelix was also an investor in that along with Skip Capital. So it was quite a buzz for me to get our name on the three of them in that announcement. And then the last one was Schedulo. So Schedulo raised $75 million. Yeah, look, Blackbird's amongst all three. So Holly, any observations on these? You know, you are a Blackbird portfolio. So tell us about these deals and what you know.
Well, to be honest, I spend most of my time heads down focused on our companies.
That's the right answer. That was a test.
I don't focus too much time. I don't know if that's selfish or like who's raising what. But I think it's absolutely awesome to see like what Blackbird have done in the community. Like even just back in the day when they had their first fund, which I think has done quite well as well. It was a lot smaller. And now I think it's awesome to see that Aussie companies, number one, Blackbird's taking crazy bets, which I think is really exciting. It gives people the opportunity to build out their vision, which I wouldn't say, like even saying 5.1 is a small round, like that's huge. Seed rounds were never this size before. And I think what's exciting about this is it gives Australian companies the opportunity to play at an international level. So I would say these are rounds are the same size rounds that are happening in the US. And that gives us a competitive edge. Yeah, I definitely think I do know the founders of two of those companies. And so it's really great to see.
Yeah. Hugh, any thoughts on this? I mean, are we seeing more bigger deals getting announced all the time, or is this a bit of an outlier?
I mean, I think I would say, you know, the old adage of your fund size drives your strategy, you know, and I think what we've seen in Australia is obviously, you know, the sort of five or six biggest funds in the country are raising bigger and bigger funds each time. And that's a great sign for the local ecosystem. And it means that we obviously have a lot more capital available for startups across, you know, across all stages. But, you know, when we talk about, you know, Blackbird takes a lot of risk, it's going to go, well, you know, big fund, big risk. You know, that's the game. And so that sort of is part of that element of, I think, you know, where we spend a lot of time talking to founders, you know, generally about, you know, really understanding, I guess, the business model of VC. And I think there's probably a lack of knowledge and education about how VC itself operates. Like I stepped into being a VC and I had to learn it all myself, right? I was a bootstrap founder beforehand. So as a result, it's sort of like you do learn all of these things about, okay, well, you know, what is actually a thesis? You know, what how does that actually operate? And what does that mean in terms of the sort of universe of things that you can or can't invest in, you know, and how does that then drive the deals that you need to be able to find and the risk that you need to take and, you know, the types of founders that you need to aim to back. You know, and I think that's where, you know, we are seeing a lot more of those things happen at the later stage. And a lot of these companies probably would have had rounds led by overseas investors in the past. And now we're lucky enough that we have large enough funds locally that, you know, hey, that, you know, they can you know, they can lead a major round, you know, of that kind of size, and comfortably do it, you know, without really feeling like they're putting half the fund into one investment or something. They can comfortably do that. And I think that's a really fantastic sign for the ecosystem as it kind of matures.
And the Schedulo, I mean, that's an interesting one because it was Brisbane based. Matt, what's his surname? Holly? Might be one of the ones that you know. Holly's looking quizzical. She's Googling quickly.
Yeah.
Anyway, Matt, I have met Matt and he's an amazing guy. I mean, they raised some money a while ago and I think they've been responsible for quite a lot of the COVID vaccination scheduling for the US medical system. I think they tried to sell it to the Aussie medical system and said, no, we don't need it. I think that's one of the punchlines in the article. And I don't know whether that's, you know, there's probably more to that story than just a quick throwaway like that. But it's just a great success story of an Aussie company who's done incredibly well. I mean, that's a huge round, $75 million for a business like that. So, like, good on him. You can almost understand why you need $50 million to build a rocket company. I mean, that involves hardware and throwing things into space, but, you know, hiring a bunch of software engineers and salespeople with $75 million. I mean, it's not something that you see every day in Australia. So congrats to all of them. Brandon Capital, I don't think we'll dwell on this one, but it was a $10 million funding. Brandon is a med tech focused fund. Really good performer. We actually had Stephen Thompson on the podcast a while ago, and great story. And they backed, Brandon, well, it was Uniseed as well, and it was a cancer biotech startup, and they got $10 million. So that was a good deal for all involved there. So congrats. Look, there's a couple other deals, but I kind of want to jump onto a different topic. There was a story in the AFR last week about Waddle. So Waddle was, a Sydney startup, but they sold the business for $31 million to Xero, X-E-R-O, last year. And they just announced a deal to get that software deployed across all of CommBank. And the question in the article, which was by Adir Schiffman, who's a great founder behind Catapult, is, are Aussie founders ambitious enough? You know, should they have hung on for a bit longer and added a zero or two zeros to that valuation, or were they right to sell out? You know, young founders, they probably pulled $5 to $10 million each off the table. Is that enough? Is it about the money? Hugh, I was going to throw this one to you. What's when you read this and hear me talking about it, what are you thinking?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it's really hard, you know, and this is always a very difficult question. And this is kind of where, I guess, in some ways you do start seeing the conflicts appear between, you know, VCs and founders, because for particularly a younger founder, you know, $5, $10, $20 million exit is a great exit. You know, it's an amazing exit, you know, whereas for a VC, you know, $30 million doesn't move the needle. You know, if I've got a $500 million fund, $30 million, you know, that's not really going to help me very much. I'm not going to be able to return capital to my LPs for that. I think that's where
Alectus invested in this one, and I think they made 2x their money. I mean, it was in a short period of time, but, you know, as a fund, it's not moving the needle, to your point.
Yeah. So, I think that's part of that sort of nature of understanding the business model of VC and, you know, why, you know, we call, you know, the whole, you know, baseball game kind of thing. It's all about home runs. But I think the other question here is to say, like, you know, would Commonwealth Bank have chosen Waddle to power their, you know, factoring and financing system? Was it not for the fact that it was at that point owned by a listed company, you know, big listed company, you know, Xero's not small. They've obviously got distribution, they've got reach, they've got that professionalized level of software engineering that probably you wouldn't necessarily see elsewhere, particularly in a startup. By nature of being a big, hulky, potentially slow-moving, depending on how you might want to think about it, but, you know, hey, that's why acquisitions happen, you know, kind of company. And so I think that there is a big question here of saying, well, you know, is, you know, would this deal have happened without Xero? I don't know. I don't really know. You know, I think it's something it's very easy to look back on retrospectively and go, well, you know, did they leave all this money on the table? And I would sort of say, well, you know, I presume, or I hope that the founders did that math in their heads and sort of go, well, okay, you know, could we go and raise money and take potentially, you know, let's say if they did say they took $10 million each off the table, you know, could we have actually taken 3 or 4 each in secondary and, you know, in a bigger round and then be able to, you know, kind of keep on the journey and sort of double down again? I don't know. Hopefully they thought about that and they sort of did all those early conversations around saying, hey, you know, would we actually be able to raise $20 million and, you know, and take 8 off the table as founders? You know, would investors, you know, bite at that or not? And you know, hopefully they were able to do that math. And you know, and assuming they did, maybe they came out with saying, okay, well, you know, this is actually the best outcome, you know, for us in the business.
Yeah, and Holly, I mean, like you've been a founder for quite a few years now. I mean, the reality is most founders are, you know, they continuously have either approaches or people kicking the tires or some sort of, you know, do you want to merge or, you know, do an acquisition. I mean, you've either had those conversations or trying to put yourself in the shoes of the Waddle founders and others who may have had this or having it now. Any thoughts or observations? How does it make you feel?
I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that they sold. I mean, I think even if they did weigh that up, there is also a lot of pressure that comes with VC money. And they probably also got some stock in Xero. And so they can continue building out their vision, but with less risk on their side. So exactly what Hugh said is it is, depending on your age or what your life budget is, it is a lot of money. It's life-changing money. And so I think I have, sorry, it's a bit noisy outside. People are buying up Shopify apps. There are private equity firms. There are sort of micro funds. And I have people who constantly contact me about Pixie. And it is something you do think about. Like, what would this be like rather than taking on investment? Because you're actually now expected to 10x your return for investors.
I'd always say 100x there.
Or 100x, but like minimum 10x.
But for you, yeah, so I mean, for you, Pixie's a little different because you're a bit more arm's length from that. So I suspect your propensity to say yes to that is going to be different to what you're doing with Carted. Is that fair to say?
I mean, yeah, we've definitely taken a different route. We've taken on venture money, and there is, you're going big or nothing in a way. And so you are taking crazier bets. With Pixie, I'm in a fortunate position. It generates cash. I have a team who runs it. I don't have to do a lot. But at the same time, instead of having money tied up in a business that could, you know, business is always a risk, I could cash out, pass that on to somebody else and not have to work, really. So not that I wouldn't not work, but...
That was going to be my next point. I mean, and you kind of, we joked on it a bit earlier where I asked you about these deals. It's like, well, I don't know because I'm focused on my business and don't really care about the rest. It's not, you said it in those terms, but you are so focused on your business that the rest of the world doesn't really encroach. And, you know, that's the right approach. Like, you are a founder. You are passionate about the problem you're trying to solve. And I don't think you started Pixie or Carted. And I'm putting words in your mouth here and you can tell us if I'm wrong, but you didn't do it for the money. And most founders don't. 100%. I mean, do you want to touch on that and just that level of, you know, the difference between ambition and wealth?
Well, I think you definitely have to be passionate about the problem you're solving and the customers you're solving for. There's definitely been times where people bring ideas to me and yeah, they're exciting, but honestly, like if there was an issue one day, I wouldn't be passionate about solving it. So I wouldn't keep going. So I think like I've always been in commerce, but that's because I'm really passionate about how helping merchants or helping businesses, whether that be automate their business and make it more profitable and more automated, or it's like today helping developers build new commerce experiences or helping shoppers have a better shopping experience. It's all sort of within the same area, an industry that I know and I absolutely love. But if you told me, there were definitely times we were fundraising last year because we actually built a shoppable TikTok feed app. And we were told by some investors, you should just pivot. You should build a video shopping app for consumers, not for the merchant side. And although it looked great and video commerce is taking off, I found it really hard to then flip to build a video shopping app because it was just not something I was passionate about.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And Hugh, I mean, again, just thinking about the, from a VC perspective, and if you had a founder that's asking you for advice in this, I mean, say, for example, you had invested in Waddle. I mean, we don't know the whole story there, but I mean, like Gelix has got a similar story where a founder, we had an exit and, you know, they exited quite early. And we ended up supporting the founder rather than, you know, because I think if they dug their heels in and worked for a few more years, we could have added a zero to the valuation that they got and that we would have got. But ultimately for them, it was a much, it was the right approach. You know, so when, as a VC, do you support the founders versus supporting, again, quote marks around that, your LPs and trying to maximize the return in the fund, even if that means pushing the founders to do what they may not otherwise have done?
Yeah, it's a really hard question. You know, I think every VC likes to say that they're founder friendly, but that's kind of bullshit. I'll be honest. You know, you can be
appreciate
you can,
the honesty.
No, really, like you can be as founder aligned as you want, but I mean, like realistically, VCs are kind of like a marketplace business. You know, on one side you have investors, on the other side you have founders. And yes, you've got to be friendly enough to the founders to be able to get deals, right? If you are known to be the VC that just spends their entire time knifing founders and being an absolute nightmare to a founder, you're not going to get any deals. What a surprise. On the other side, you know, for your LPs, you still have to generate returns. You know, like this is still a financial services business. And people, I think, sometimes forget that it's not like, oh, yes, you know, we just sit around on our wonderful golden chairs that our LPs give us on, you know, gigantic management fees that don't exist. We don't do that. But we have to actually return money. If we don't return money, we effectively, as a manager, if you don't return money, you effectively don't get paid. You know, like there's not a lot of actual cash, particularly, you know, in smaller funds, but there's not actually a lot of cash left over to just sort of pay gigantic salaries for the fun of it or anything. Like you really are measured on returns. And so I think, you know, again, that's where we do start seeing those things cross over. And kind of, I guess what I say to a lot of founders is like, there comes a point when you're a founder when you're like, are you done with this? You know, and that's really the point where it's like, when you feel like you're done is when you need to make change. And whether that is, okay, I'm going to go and explore an exit, whether that is, okay, I'm going to go and try and hire a GM and I'm going to move into like an executive chairman type role or whatever it might be. You know, whatever that path is, you know, you need to realize when you reach that point of I'm done with this, what you're actually going to do. You know, and you should talk to your VCs and you should talk to your, you know, talk to people that have exited, you know, because I think if you talk to a lot of the M&A investment bankers and lawyers, they'll tell you all of these stories about founders that exit and then they go, oh shit, what do I do now? And they just get lost. You know, and I think it's one of the biggest things that, you know, one of a friend of mine, Tom Ellis, will tell you, who sort of works in that M&A space, he'll tell you that the first question he asks every single person that comes to him talking about an exit is, what are you going to do afterwards? Do you actually have an idea of what it is you're going to do with your life after this has actually closed? Because otherwise you will go insane. Because founders love building. You know, founders love building. They love, you know, getting like, you know, deep in the trenches, all that kind of stuff. And it just goes 100 to 0 and they just go absolutely nuts. And so I think it is really much about like, if you've lost that passion, yeah, absolutely. Like it's time to make change and whatever that change might look like, whether that is, you know, being able to step away operationally from the business a little bit and sit in a different kind of role, whether that is actually exploring an exit to someone else in the market. But, you know, you really need to be able to work out what are you actually going to fill your life with. And I think Holly's probably a good example of where you go, okay, well, you know, I've been able to step away from the operational part of that business to be able to step into the operational part of another business. You know, and that's sort of, you know, that they're those things you have to be able to weigh up as a founder.
And Holly, you were nodding and smiling all the way through what Hugh was saying there. Like, any observations of what he said?
So a bit about what I was talking about before, that there are a lot of people acquiring apps in the Shopify app marketplace ecosystem. And a friend sold his company at the end of 2019. And to be honest, I think he's been a bit lost for a year. He's not too sure what to do. He started again, and like starting again is hard. I'm starting again. But like we're in a fortunate position where we have traction on our apps in the Shopify app store. And I can't imagine having to start again and knowing what you should do. I mean, in a way, it's a first world problem, having the choice to do something else. And if I didn't have companies, I would probably go get a job for a while and see something completely different because being a founder is hard. But I definitely know that some of the people who have sold their company, they didn't think about what they would do next. They joined a company that bought them for about 6 months, 6 to 12 months, and then they wanted to have change, but they didn't know what to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe just some quick observations from my side with our case study with this one. I mean, ultimately we backed the founders and their decision on it. I mean, it was a little easier for us because, you know, we were running as a syndicate rather than as a fund. And I think with a fund, the decision is more difficult because you're making most of your money in the fund from a small handful of companies. Whereas in a syndicate, you know, we were going to get a great return. We ended up getting 10 times cash return within 3.5 years. So it was an amazing outcome for us. But for the founders, it was life changing. You know, it wasn't, a colossal exit, you know, it's sub $100 million for them. But they did well. They wanted to spend more time with the kids and they'd been doing really hard for a few years. And we supported that. And yeah, looking back, I mean, we're friends with them now and we see them regularly. And, you know, it just makes us feel good that we supported them to make the right decision for them. So it's very nuanced though, and there's no easy answer on it, but it's a really interesting debate, you know, that, you know, ambition versus wealth. All right, let's see if there's any other stories in here. So Nextdoor, which is a US community social media, I guess is the best way of putting it. They've got hundreds of millions of users around the world. If you're in Bondi Junction or Fairfield or whatever, you can, you know, go onto this app and have a chat about what's going on. They have just done a SPAC, and I can't remember the whole details of this, but it basically valued them over $4 billion. They were out in Australia. They we did an event with them, must be 3 years ago. I was still at AWS. I remember it. Great company, fantastic progress. Huge. Do you know much about Nextdoor? And if you don't, then tell us about SPACs and what your thoughts on them are.
I mean, I describe Nextdoor as like those local geography or local council Facebook groups, but just sort of like specific to it, right? Yeah. And everyone's been in those Facebook groups of where it's, you know, various people of different age ranges making different arguments and seeing the way that perhaps different people approach the concept of social media.
Yeah, not altogether civilized is maybe
not altogether civilized. That's a nice way to put it. I mean, I think, you know, I think it is, I mean, it's still a very US-centric business. You know, we have sort of seen them try and launch it to Australia, but it hasn't really, I think, taken a big hold, at least that I've seen. But, you know, I think there's a really big question here of like, SPACs are really hard, right? Because it's like they were really, really, really sexy and now it's just something like, ooh, now they're not as sexy. You know, we've kind of seen a lot of them cool off quite a lot. And it's a really interesting dynamic in the way that, you know, you can actually, you know, Matt Levine, one of my favorite newsletters is Matt Levine's Money Stuff, who's a Bloomberg columnist who writes this very, very dry humor newsletter, but actually does a really, really good job distilling kind of principles of financial. He's an ex-Goldman Sachs banker, does a really good job of just sort of distilling these things into, you know, what is quite, you know, quite readable content compared to a lot of things in financial services. But it's this big thing of like, well, you know, this is sort of one of the ones where Kozla Ventures was the sponsor of the SPAC. They weren't actually an investor in Nextdoor, but for the sponsor, often you see about a 20% uplift. So if they manage to close the deal, you know, they're making a whole lot of money on this deal.
Which is not really a venture. I mean, that's more a banker approach, isn't it?
Like, correct. Yeah, 100%. You know, but I think it was one of those things where, you know, as soon as you start seeing these kinds of deals appear, then suddenly you go, oh, we should have one, right? We should have one. And anyone with a brand and, you know, there's that joking thing of like, you'll just find a random person and then just tack on a sports person. And you could just say to the sports person, hey, we're going to get 20% proceeds of this deal. We'll cut you in for 5% to do nothing other than when we walk around promoting this SPAC, we'll be able to say, hey, do you want to meet your favorite sports star? You should sell to our SPAC. Which sounds ridiculous, but you're like, well, you know, if you're comparing one SPAC with the other and you really love LeBron James and he's a, you know, he's on the board of this other random SPAC for no reason other than he gets 5% promote fee, why wouldn't you go there? You know, like it's sort of this very, very weird dynamic of how the whole thing worked. And, you know, we don't really, you know, backdoor listings, reverse listings were very common in Australia, you know, I'll say way back when, you know, like early
2000s. Ago. There was almost 100 of them, but I mean, they didn't end up quite as well. So, I mean, that's an interesting one. And I'd love to hear your thoughts in the similarity or not between those reverse listings that we saw here and what's going on with SPACs now in the US.
I mean, it is almost like an empty shell company. The only difference is probably it doesn't have an operating history the way that it does for reverse listing, but it has some of the same kinds of principles, right? Where the you know, the regulatory process to be able to sort of merge into a SPAC, so to say, is very different to the regulatory process to IPO. You know, there's a different level of disclosures. You can do different, you know, you can provide different information to the prospective investors. It's a different process that has obviously has benefits for some businesses and disadvantages for others. And that was really a lot of the journey of the reverse listing world, right? Was being able to go, well, okay, you know, we don't necessarily have to go through the same degree of compliance and regulatory pain to be able to become a listed company. And for a lot of people that own shares in these sort of, you know, dead mining shells and things like that, well, you know, it was an opportunity to be able to potentially still see some value out of their investment. Probably got mostly wiped out, but, you know, maybe this one will be better. So, you know, it is a bit different in that sense. And you've kind of got all these interesting dynamics about how unlike, you know, unlike other things, you know, a SPAC, you know, often has a pipe on the other side. And so there's sort of all of these different ways that the money actually comes in, and it's not necessarily guaranteed, and you know, how's it unwritten, and all those other bits and pieces that are a bit different to perhaps what you'd see in, you know, the old sort of backdoor listing. But, you know, I think in some ways, you know, from that regulatory standpoint, they are very similar, and Australia sort of moved away from them because I think a lot of the results, as you said, Ian, you know, weren't particularly great for investors.
Yeah, I think out of the 90 or 100 that were conducted, there was less than half a dozen actually made it. I mean, it tended to be, because we saw it, it was sort of, you know, not great startups that couldn't raise money from VCs and angels. And then, you know, there was a Perth banker standing with his shiny shoes on, suggesting that they come and look at this, and they went with it, which is never a great scenario for this. Holly, I mean, is this relevant to you or probably most of the audience listening, or is this just a bit of a distraction that's happening in the US?
I would say it's a distraction,
yeah.
But definitely not really in my space. I guess it's later stage companies.
Yeah.
It's funny. I think I went to Nextdoor's office like way back when, 2014. Oh, yeah. Maybe.
I'm sure they had a very nice office, and because they were heavily venture backed in the middle of San Francisco.
Yeah. They were. Yeah, they were. Yeah. And I think being starry eyed when you arrive in the valley and you're like, how did this company raise so much money? And I've never heard of them.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, look, a couple more stories, I think, and then we'll call it. So there was one here. So Wise, which used to be called TransferWise, I'm a customer. I mean, it's basically a better and easier way of transferring money in different currencies around the world. We actually had I've forgotten the guys. Can either of you remember the CEO's name? Tavid, is it?
On terrible names.
You guys are young.
I love Google TransferWise.
Anyway, he was on the podcast 2 years ago. Wow. An amazing guy out of London. They have just listed on the London Stock Exchange, valuing them at over $11 billion. So, you know, that's a decacorn, I think you call them. So congrats to them. Are you guys customers? Holly, you're transferring money, I'm sure. Yeah?
Is that been transferring money for a while now by TransferWise. I love it.
It's
I'm surprised how so many good. People still don't know about know. It.
It is astonishing because, you know, it's basically it costs you 10% more if you're using the banks.
Yeah.
Well, I'll say it does if you don't have negotiated rates.
Oh, okay. All right, there you go.
So that's the other key that I think is part of this whole sort of consumerization of finance, where we've seen stuff like Wise really become quite popular. So, you know, we operate across four currencies, the bootstrap company that I run. And, you know, we have our primary big four bank, we have their foreign exchange, we have TransferWise, we have OFX, and we have WorldFirst. So we actually use four different exchange providers. And we'll use each of those individually for different purposes, because they will do different remittance rates and different sort of degrees of convenience for the receiving party as well. But we'll use them differently depending on what it is that you want to be able to do, because you can actually definitely get better rates through a bank's foreign exchange desk. You just need to be actually transacting enough for them to see it as worth their while.
Yeah.
And for a consumer, it's not worth their while.
No, it's definitely not. You just want the several clicks without having to speak to anyone and get the best rate out there. And that seems to be the way that these guys have operated. Probably the only, it's not the only interesting thing. I mean, the fact is it's massive and they've done a great job, but it was a direct listing. Hugh, do you want to give us an insight into direct listing versus using a bank?
Sure. I mean, so I guess the easy answer to direct listing is really just saying that, you know, day zero, suddenly everyone can buy and sell shares. You know, and in traditional IPO, you've got, you know, lockups and you've got pre-IPO rounds and you've got various different bits and pieces. Whereas in a direct listing, effectively, you know, you sort of go from being able to, no one can actually sell and buy their shares to suddenly everyone can sell and buy their shares. And so it's a different journey, different path. You know, it was sort of probably started by Spotify was the first big one, I think
that's
memory.
Right. Yep.
And, you know, that's a really interesting thing. And the Slack idea, I guess, in a sense
that,
sorry?
I think Slack did directly.
Yeah, Slack did one as well. Yeah. So the concept of them was like, people always said that like, oh, the IPO pop and, you know, what does that mean for, you know, has the company left money on the table? And, you know, when it goes up 20% on day one, you know, and is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Are you rewarding, you know, your sort of pre-IPO round investors or not? You know, that was kind of where it was like, oh, you know, direct listing solved this problem because suddenly, you know, people can just buy and sell stuff when they want. And so I think it's, again, I think with the, alongside the SPACs thing, I think it's that whole element of it's good to have more avenues for founders to exit and VCs and everyone else to be able to exit. And the right path, I guess, will depend a lot on, you know, what's happening in the market and what's kind of, I'll say what's kind of trendy. But also, you know, the unique environment of, you know, what does the cap table look like? What do investors' expectations look like? You know, what are founders' expectations look like? What are employees' expectations look like for this kind of business? And so I think in many ways, my view is to say like more avenues is good, you know, gives people more choices and optionality is a fantastic thing. So, you know, I think obviously it's a great business. You definitely can't say it's not, you know, everything is a fintech and, you know, it's definitely very much revolutionized that sort of simplicity of UX in a way that absolutely, like, let me tell you now, the big force foreign exchange platforms, like, you know,
you should see the banks in America.
The one that we use, they just like proudly rolled out a new international payment system and you're just like, holy crap, this is still so bad.
So backwards.
Like, you know, almost impossible to use.
That's astonishing. They still send checks to each other, don't they?
Oh, we get posted checks by American companies.
Oh, and there's also wire cutoff times in the US. You have to transfer your money by a certain time, otherwise it gets delayed by 24 hours.
It is astonishing. Yeah, no, we're at a bank in Colorado and, you know, there was some sort of fee refund. So they posted us a check for $45 to Australia. And I'm like, what on earth am I meant to do with a $45 check?
And this is the astonishing thing, is to bank a US check, what they do is the bank will buy the check from you and then they stamp it in Australia. They post it to America. It gets counter-stamped and then it gets post back to Australia and then they'll actually credit you the money. Like, the check literally has to physically go from the local branch of your bank to America and back again be able to actually be credited. It's just wild.
Yeah, no, it is.
Some US companies still pay their employees with check.
Yep.
Yeah. As someone else said to me, like, the US is a very poor country with a lot of rich people.
And it's amazing sometimes seeing the way that the American ecosystem will celebrate this incredible innovation and you're like, the rest of the world has had this for a very long time.
Yeah. Like, Venmo. Wow.
Like, yeah, exactly. You're like, everyone's like, oh, Venmo, it's amazing. And you're like, oh, yeah, everyone else just uses their back.
Well, you forget.
Yeah,
you know,
and you just text someone.
Their world vision is a little bit blinkered. I mean, the World Series is actually not for anyone outside the US. I mean, that's... Anyway, let's not get it. Like, the US is a great place. Let's not get into US bashing. We actually like them a lot.
Yeah.
Certainly. all right, look, let's take one more story and I'll let you guys choose. So there's one here about Andrew Forrest joining Bill Gates and a few other billionaires in a green venture fund. So that's quite interesting. There's another interesting one with CSL, which is a big medtech business. It's not a startup, but they are planning a Melbourne incubator to focus on biotech startups. So which one do we want to talk about?
Oh, I am not picky on what topic we discuss, but I definitely think starting an incubator in Melbourne sounds interesting.
All right, well, let's do that.
Let's go.
So, I mean, CSL, I think they were the guys that were handed the contract to do the AstraZeneca vaccination.
Manufacturing.
That's right, isn't it, Hugh?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you know much about these guys? Because, I mean, Galileo has a sort of, you know, your early, James in particular came out of Incubate. And I think, you know, you certainly both had exposure to that early stage. So this is probably in your sweet spot. So is this exciting to Galileo?
CSL, less so.
I mean, maybe not CSL, but, you know, the point is that they should be spinning out Galileo investable businesses. Is that right?
Yeah, you'd hope. I mean, you definitely hope. Certainly a lot of our deal flow comes from universities, and whether that's universities from what we call student intellectual property, student IP, where generally the university has no ownership, through to this kind of, you know, more traditional sort of research IP commercialization route where you've got, you know, Main Sequence and IP Group and people like that are also kind of investing in that space. Or even, you know, in biotech and medtech, you've got people like Brandon, obviously, that's probably the best performing or one of the best performing medtech focused VC funds in Australia. I think it's really interesting because I think in Australia, you know, speaking of something, so I was actually a medical student before I dropped out.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, interesting.
So, fun fact. And it's interesting because in Australia, you know, we have Cochlear, which is, you know, one of the world's best med tech companies. We've got ResMed, same thing, you know, and that's run out of Bella Vista in Sydney, you know, and you know, we've got CSL, which is one of the world's top manufacturers of biotherapeutics. You know, a lot of the anti-venoms and all sorts of stuff is all CSL manufactured for pretty much everywhere around the world. And so we actually have a really good heritage in this kind of world, but bizarrely, there isn't that same, you know, we have sort of the MedTech Actuator, which is kind of a, I guess, an early stage accelerator, you know, sort of like start maker for MedTech, I guess. You know, but we don't really have a lot of focus. You know, we have firms like Brandon, we have firms like Main Sequence and IP Group and stuff like that sort of looking in this space, but we haven't actually seen, you know, I think it's probably the first time we've seen one of those big sort of MedTech, biotech companies in Australia actually try and do corporate venture. And that's going to be really interesting to follow.
It was interesting. I'm really curious to see how it goes. There's no mention in this. The article was in the Fin Review last week. There's no mention of the amount of money that's going into it. I mean, it's just talking about, you know, it's going to devote several floors of its new 18-story head office and research center. And Brandon's somewhat involved. So I don't know whether not putting a number in there is relevant or whether that just wasn't covered. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, we'll see what deals happen is kind of where I would say. And I think there's a question here of, you know, traditionally a lot of these companies are kind of incubated, I guess, by the universities. You know, they're given sort of lab space and an office space at the universities and then eventually, you know, either get bought out of the university itself, or they, you know, sort of grow large enough that they build their own facilities or build their own, you know, offices. But it's interesting, that journey is interesting to see, you know, and we'll sort of see whether that is something where it's just like purely office space and, you know, kind of that sort of co-working space type vibe of saying, hey, you know, we're going to have all these, you know, med tech companies or biotech companies in this space. You should come and join this space because then you can sort of meet other people doing similar things, or whether it is going to be a sort of more traditional corporate venture, you know, hey, we're going to invest and, you know, here's the equity that we expect. And we'll sort of see, you know, how they end up actually structuring that, you know, outside of that. But I think it's like that. I think it's a good thing. I think it's a positive sign. I think there is a lot of founders. We are certainly seeing a lot more of those researcher, what we call researcher founders. We're seeing a lot more that are interested in actually operating, researcher operators that actually want to run a startup or run a business. Whereas traditionally, you might only ever, you know, traditionally they might have the view of, oh, I'll just become the chief research officer and we'll hire a professional CEO, we'll hire a professional COO and all that kind of stuff. And now I think we're seeing a lot more of them saying, actually, I want to run this business.
Holly, let me ask you a sort of slightly different angle on this question. Do you know any startup founders who are running med tech startups?
No. I mean, the closest thing is Health Match because they're also in Surry Hills. Okay. But yeah. I would say, no, it's definitely not my space at all. But I definitely, like, I get really excited when there's, like, sort of innovative areas that were exactly what Hugh was saying, like, in the universities previously. And now investors are looking at new companies in the space. I think it would be interesting to see how many people, like, how much of the commercialization side that they need help with, rather than, like, obviously they come out of universities, but then what do they need on the business side to commercialize that? I know it's always been a challenge for some people, but as Hugh mentioned, which I didn't realize, is that they actually do want to run the company. So they probably also have business acumen as well.
Not all of them do. And I think we always have the conversation with them and saying, you know, hey, do you actually want to be a founder? You know, do you want to be that person that runs a business, or do you just want to, you know, for some of them, it's just literally, oh, I want to be able to pass off this IP and then move on to the next bit of research I want to do. And that's also, you know, that's also great. I think it's just about having that. I think we need to make sure to founders that they have that kind of, I guess, self-awareness in the type of company and the type of business that they want to run. You know, we have the same conversation with bootstrappers that are looking to go and raise. You know, is this the sort of company you want to run? Do you want to run a VC-backed business? Do you want to run a bootstrap business? You know, what are those trade-offs? What does that mean? You know, I don't want to be a researcher full-time forever. Do I want to run an SME? Do I want to run a venture company? What do I want to actually do? And I think, you know, really as a founder, you need to be able to weigh up those different options and have a clear idea as to what it is that you want to do, because no one else can sort of push that on you externally. And if they do, then it always ends up being a bad outcome.
Yeah. I think it'd be really cool match, like, have community, you know, match the community with people who do want to commercialize technology, because there's a ton of people out there who are great at business. And they can actually see how technology, whether it's med tech or another space, how it can be commercialized.
Yeah, I mean, I'd definitely love to see more med tech in the ecosystem. And again, using that broadly, because I know they are part of the ecosystem, but you don't tend to see them. You know, they're not typical cohort members at StartMate or, you know, Murudi when it was going, or any of the other accelerators. And, you know, and Brandon's part of the ecosystem, but we don't often see too much of them out there. There's not much in the way of deal sharing or as much collaboration as maybe there could be. So, you know, I guess it's a call if you're a med tech startup or working in medicine and thinking about getting into this, then, you know, come and join the ecosystem. I would love to see you.
Yeah, hit us up.
All right, look, we are out of time. That was fantastic. Thank you, Holly. Thank you, Hugh. Good luck
Thanks
with lockdown, Holly, and hope you get out soon and get back to San Francisco. And you don't gloat too much and enjoy having your coffees in the Melbourne sunshine.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for joining, and we'll see you in the next one.